Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Dan Lynch joins me. We're going to be talking about This Week in Linux. Michael Tunnell's going to be coming on to talk about his podcast. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Dan Lynch, episode 505, recorded November 7th, 2018, This Week in Linux. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/floss. And by DigitalOcean, the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications. Over 150,000 businesses rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twit. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day and not aware of it, projects you might want to download right after this show and play with, and sometimes, occasionally, we're talking about podcasts, as we are today. Joining me once again is my lovely and talented co-host, Dan Lynch. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Randall, it's good to be back.
And where are you speaking to us from?
I am speaking to you from my studio / spare bedroom in my house, which is near Liverpool in the UK. And as you've seen on the video, anyone watching, it's now cactus country here. It's so warm that we've got a cactus on the shelf behind. That might be more to do with the central heating in my house than the external temperature, though, I have to admit.
Well, I can imagine, since that's, bloody old England, that it's going to be a bit cool this time of year, right?
Yeah, it is a bit. We've just had Guy Fawkes Night as well, which I know isn't a thing in the US, obviously, but November the 5th for us is a big thing where we have big bonfires and fireworks and so on, which is cool. So, yeah, it's been good.
That's the one with the anonymous masks, right? That the anonymous has subrogated for their own choice of being able to be anonymous and stuff. Yes. So I am speaking to you not from home, but very close to home. I am about an hour and a half drive from there. I am in Seaside, Oregon. I am facing the Pacific Ocean, which is right out there. The sunlight you're seeing behind me is, in fact, from outside and from the ocean there. And I am at the end of the Lewis and Clark Trail, not the beginning. We were discussing this before the show, that St. Louis claims to be the end of the trail. But no, they're the beginning of the trail. They need to change their signs because it's the end of the trail or here and the beginning of the trail back there. So that's how that is. So today we have an interesting guest on, not like the rest of them aren't, but today we have a guest. Michael Tunnell is going to be coming on in a few minutes, talking to us about his podcast. I'm sure you've heard of podcasts. You're probably listening to one right now or watching one right now. He's got a podcast that he's been doing for a little while called This Week in Linux. And we're going to talk to him about how he prepares it, how he produces it, what it's like to be on a podcast, what it's like to not have a co-host, which I'm thankfully not have that problem, because I have these like Dan and my wonderful panel of rotating co-hosts. Well, they don't rotate.
I'm on a swivel chair. Sorry, that's another visual joke for everyone else there. For everyone listening, I have a swivel chair.
You could do that. I've listened to a couple of his episodes, and I like the amount of material he gathers. So one of the things I'm going to ask him is, how does he get all that material? Where does he get it from? You know, because that's that's always interesting. And Dan, you had this little Linux podcast you did for a while as well, right?
Yeah. And I think, well, we had the show that we did fairly recently with Fab, who's my co-host. And I've got to admit, when you say, how did they get all the news and stuff? I just completely, you know, delegated all that to him towards the end. And he just did it. And then I would read it in the notes. And I don't know where he got it all from. But that's always a challenge, is keeping up on what's going on. And then, you know, making sure. Because the other thing is, when you're doing a topical kind of news show, if someone listens to it, say, a week after you put it out, the stories may have changed significantly. So that's quite difficult. And then they email you saying you've got that wrong, and you have to say, well, look at the release date on the show. It's not actually wrong. It was right at the time I released it. And then, you know, things like that. But yeah, it's a big challenge getting all the news in and reading through it, working out what the angle is on each story or whatever.
Yeah, news is tough because it's like, I listened to the NPR podcast called Politics or Politics Now or something like that. And they always say exactly the date and time it was recorded on. And they say, and they always say right after that, things may have changed since we recorded this. And almost always things have changed because politics, it moves, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a little crazy that way, right? So that's the way that works. But before we bring on Michael Tunnell, which we will in a moment, I do have an important message, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Let's talk about buying a home for a minute. Because of rising interest rates, there's a lot of unpredictability when it comes to buying a home these days. It's causing a lot of anxiety with folks. Well, our friends at Quicken Loans are doing something about that. They're calling it the power buying process. Here's how it works. Step one, answer a few simple questions, and they'll check your credit for pre-qualified approval. Step two, Quicken Loans will verify your income, assets, and credit in less than 24 hours to give you a verified approval, which gives you the strength of a cash buyer. Step three, once you're verified, you qualify for their all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. First, they'll lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. Now, here's the best part. If rates go up, your rate stays the same, but if rates go down, your rate also drops. Either way, you win. It's the kind of thinking you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/floss. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply, based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. That's rocketmortgage.com/floss. rocketmortgage.com/FLOSS. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Floss Weekly. Let's go ahead and bring on our guest today. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Cool. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm from Birmingham, Alabama.
So you're sort of down diagonally that way. I think that's, I don't think I've flown over that recently. Well, I went from Fort Lauderdale, so I guess I kind of flew over you at one point recently.
It's not the most touristic area, I'll have to admit that.
I'm actually wondering if I've ever actually been in Alabama. I've been to most states, but I don't think I've been to Alabama. Not to say anything bad about Alabama, just that, you know, I go where I'm needed. I'm like Superman, right?
The most attractive thing in the South is Atlanta, which is like just an hour or about 2 hours away from Birmingham. There's really no reason to go to Birmingham because Atlanta's right there. So.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah.
Well, I've
been in Atlanta many times. So for Dragon Con and a bunch of other things there too. And also because that's like one of the hubs of Delta. So I go there a lot for going everywhere else in the world as well. Anyway, so enough about that. Enough about this week in where we are. Talk to us about how did you get involved with open source?
I just got interested in Linux and open source in the 98-ish. I was a teenager at the time, and there was I was watching. I'm pretty sure it was ZDTV at the time, versus when it became Tech TV. It was there was an episode where on the screensavers, Leo was interviewing Linus Torvalds, and he was explaining like the different operating system, and I was just. You just wanted to try out things. And I didn't actually get a chance to try at the time, it took me another year before I found a friend who had cable internet so I could actually download the ISO to try it out. But I was interested in the general aspect of open source around 98, 99. So it was just mainly because I saw the interview on ZDTV.
Wow. So that was really inspiring to you. That's really amazing. And so have you been working with open source since then?
Yeah, I've been working on so many projects. I can't remember all of them, but I've been contributing to various Linux distributions, some software projects, many things that people have heard of. Like for as far as software, I've contributed to Kdenlive, Kodi, OBS in some ways. That's just Open Broadcaster Studio for those who are not aware, and various different things like that. But I've also contributed to like communities to around distributions like. The latest version of Kubuntu has a lot of influence for my design style because I'm also not only an enthusiast for Linux and open source, I'm also a designer, a writer, and a marketer. So it kind of like accidentally fell pretty well into like the needs of a lot of communities. I kind of provide a unique experience for them. So like the Kubuntu 18.04 release has so many things that if you compare Kubuntu versus any other Plasma desktop, you'll see that like just immediately there's a massive design difference, and that's what I had a hand in.
And how did you get exposed to podcasting?
Well, actually, I started working with the Jupyter Broadcasting people when they were doing the Linux Action Show, so I started producing content for them 6-7 years ago, something like that. And I kind of wanted to be a part of not only making it, but I wanted to have control of whatever the content I was making. So I branched out and started making my own stuff. And then eventually that became the This Week in Linux podcast as well as another podcast.
And what is that like to do that?
Well, the This Week in Linux is an interesting situation because like every piece of it is me. So the research, the collection of the different topics, the graphics, the switching, the editing, all that stuff is me. So there's a lot of work involved in it that a lot of times that podcasters don't typically have to deal with. Because if you don't do video, you don't have to. A lot of podcasts don't do video, so they can skip that part. But I'm a visual person. As a designer, it kind of just felt right to do that. So I have all these different effects and transitions and fades and animations and all this other stuff that I do like during live while I record with OBS. So the reason why I'm contributing to OBS is because there's a lot of things that I wanted that weren't working well. So I made some tweaks and sent them to them. And like overall, it's just more like the making the show is really fun. Mainly I do the same thing that you guys do, where you do the live streaming. I switched to doing live streaming because it gave me like a different dynamic. A couple times I will admit that I have been wrong on the show, and people in the live chat was like, well, here's where you actually kind of messed up. You might want to fix that. And then you'll see like this little weird cut where it's like, hey, I mentioned this one thing I should probably correct really quick. So.
Interesting, Michael. I was really interested in the. So you've actually hit on some of the things that we didn't do video when I did Linux Outlaws. We'll get onto OBS in a minute because I use OBS a lot, so I got some questions about that. But we did. We used to in the early days of Linux Outlaws, maybe 10, 11 years ago, a while ago. We used to get the whole thing of like the email. You'd say something like I was saying to Randall before. You'd talk about something on a show, and you'd say something wrong because you know everybody's wrong occasionally, and then we'd get like a week worth of email, people emailing us going that was wrong, and hundreds of people telling us the same thing was wrong, that necessarily, you know, so you'd end up having to deal with it on the next show. And then we started doing Icecast, so we did radio stuff because I've always been a radio guy. Anybody watching this video stream will probably realize why I've never been much of a video guy, but we did a lot of radio stuff. So I did radio, and that was brilliant because we had a live chat room as well on IRC, and then we found that there was a real advantage in not having to wait a week and have 100 people email you the same thing that you've got wrong when somebody on the chat room goes, you were wrong about that, and you can correct it. You said it's changed the dynamic. Has that been a real bonus for you?
Oh, it has. There's actually there's some negatives to it in the sense that I do more editing because of it. Because the way I do it, I want to have a section where like every couple topics that I do on the show, I want to take a break and talk to the chat room and see if they have any corrections, or if I'm something during the during the recording, they'll have some kind of input. So it doesn't happen a ton, but it does happen enough where it's a noticeable thing in the edit. So you can see where I'll finish a segment and then immediately go back into that segment, and that's pretty much when I fix things so that they've corrected for me. But there's a lot of things that people have said, like even times where it wasn't even a correction, like some people misunderstood something I said, and I go back just to make sure I clarified it in the recording.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot easier to do it that way. I mean, it makes me think of, and this is, again, probably really bad for anybody who's on the visual, who's not watching any of the video, but there's a famous XKCD comic where there's a picture of a guy's hunched over a computer, and then his wife appears in like the doorway and says, "Are you coming to bed?" And he says, "I'll be there in a minute. Someone on the internet is wrong." So you do get a bit of that. But yeah, everybody's wrong sometimes.
It's very helpful to me.
Yeah, and in terms of I'm interested in the streaming stuff. So you said you were using OBS, which I really love, and I'm doing a project at the minute, which with some friends of mine in Liverpool, we're building a platform to stream stuff fully open, from server and everything. And we used OBS quite a lot for that. So how does that look? Because on your kind of setup, what do you use? What kind of platform are you streaming to? Do you have your own servers? Do you do Facebook Live or any of these other platforms that are out there?
Well, it depends on what I'm doing for what type of content I'm doing. But if it's for the show, I'm doing a Restream broadcast. If you haven't heard of it, Restream.io, where you can just stream to them and then they'll stream to a variety of different places. So that's kind of usually what I do. If otherwise, but my main audience is definitely on YouTube, even the live stream. I have some Twitch involvement, but the YouTube has the majority of the audience for my content, mainly just because I've put more effort into the marketing of YouTube, but prior to starting Twitch, starting using Twitch anyway. So the majority of time it's just YouTube, but there's also occasionally other ones, even like Mixer and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at this quite recently, but when I looked at this last year for another project, I was looking at the whole problem with, cost of streaming and so on. And Mixer was actually really interesting. It's a Microsoft project. It was made for Xbox Live streaming, apparently, but they actually don't put they're quite good on their copyright kind of algorithms. They're not really kind of draconian about it, because one of the things with YouTube that can happen quite a lot is. I'm sure anybody who's put a video on YouTube will have experienced this. You can actually just make a video, and it's happened to me recently where I filmed something on my phone in a bar, and there was some music playing in the background which had nothing to do with the video, and people were talking over it, and the YouTube algorithm must have identified that music and sent me quite a snotty email saying, you've infringed copyright, and the copyright holder's been informed, and you might be in trouble and all this sort of stuff. And I thought, that's a bit mad. Yeah. So have you ever had any trouble with that sort of thing?
Early on, I've had issues where people would copyright claim some videos like 10 years ago, when I wasn't really doing content. I was like, oh, okay, so that's very quick. They respond very quickly, so I'm just not going to bother. So when I started doing my content, all of the music and stuff that plays on my podcasts are just, they're royalty-free types content, and typically they don't require attribution, because that way, the scanner, the content ID, is not looking into the description either. But I still give them credit in like the show notes and stuff like that. It's just like, so I can avoid YouTube as much as possible from giving me like little dings and stuff for demonetization. So I avoid it very well, but that's mainly because I'm cognizant of it at all times. And, but as far as like the Mixer thing, I do think that Mixer is an interesting platform. I would have to say that they're, moderation tools need a lot of work, because I often get spam on that platform, and if they would give me some extra options for that, it would be great. But Mixer was actually created by, I'm pretty sure it was Beam.pro, and then Microsoft bought them and converted it into Mixer, and then like made some extra modifications to it. But it's I wouldn't say it's I think it's good that they are more lenient to the copyright aspects, but for me, I don't have to worry about it anyway. So,
yeah, I mean, just to clarify, if anyone's curious, I'm not saying we should be able to stream, copyright things and do it as we want. I mean, I think the problem is when you, so in my case, I took a, you can see this is a bit of a bone of contention for me right now. I took a video in a bar and there was a Frankenstein video playing on the wall behind me, which just happened to be, it, the theme of the bar was like Frankenstein's bar. And I got a thing saying that I'd violated a copyright for the Frankenstein film, as if somebody was going to watch my 1 minute camera phone video instead of going to watch the actual Frankenstein film, which just seems crazy to me. I mean, what kind of planet are we living on that people, they think that's a threat to, you know, the copyright of the film?
They should be able to like detect how many, like how much time of this content is being played into the system. Because if they can check, like they can see it in the video, they should be able to tell how much time is being played of it. So they, that if there's a certain amount of time, there should be like a fair use and not really care. And there's also cases where people will have music playing just at a, like at a mall or whatever, and they have that demonetized as well. So like there's all kinds of different issues where it's kind of hilarious if you think about it, because YouTube has this whole, you know, getting rid of the content ID or like, you know, copyright infringement and stuff. But at the same time, they have like this massive freebooting platform of React channels where like 99% of the video is played in their thing. And all they do is like laugh or like smirk during the watching of it. It's like, yeah, so you care about like certain pieces of content, but you there's channels that entirely exist to copyright infringe and you don't seem to care. So like, it's an interesting dynamic there.
Yeah, that's very true. Before this becomes This Week in Copyright, I realize I've dragged it down that route a bit. One of the very good things about YouTube, I've found, because I've used YouTube quite a lot for the live stuff, and they've got great features on there. But actually, one of the things I really liked about it was, and especially now, is that it's so available on all kinds of devices now. Every smart TV has got a YouTube app. Everyone's got it on their phone. Mm-hmm. They've got it on the computer. So you know they can get anywhere. And actually, there's a real kind of awareness in the general public of YouTube and using YouTube. So if they say, you say I do a show and they go, well, where do I find it? And you say YouTube, they go, oh, okay, I can do that. So is that really an advantage, you think?
I think there's a significant portion of my audience that are YouTube. Like there's, I have it spread around because I do a lot of different platforms and I also have my own website that has the content. But for the majority of the time, I'd say that the space, the audience that is available on YouTube is pretty much fundamental to my content. And even like the podcast MP3 side is not as big as the side on YouTube. I mean, like they're close, but YouTube still wins for the average views kind of thing. And it's also nicer because the fact that I'm doing a video type podcast, it makes more people interested, and because they can just, you know, people are using YouTube for searching for all kinds of stuff now, even stuff that you wouldn't even expect to have videos for. And it just kind of works for me. And I don't really necessarily like the platform itself, because there's a ton of things that are incredibly irritating, but overall it's better to be using it than not.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of content, you mentioned Restream, of course, which I've used quite a lot, and that's great for, you know, for being able to stream to so many platforms at once. It's like 30 different platforms, I think. So in terms of content, my philosophy has always been get it in as many places as possible, because what you really want is people to see or hear it. You know, you want to hit as many of those things as you can. So I want to ask you quickly about cameras and stuff. I'm using a Logitech C920 on my for this video now that people will be watching if they're watching the video stream. How do you get on with things like support on Linux? Are you doing your production on Linux, and what cameras do you use for that sort of thing?
Yeah, I do everything on Linux. The production, the editing, the streaming, everything is done on Linux. And the cameras I use are, it's kind of interesting because I just recently got a new camera to replace the current one I'm using, but I haven't had the time to actually like do all the calibrations and stuff like that. So I'm currently using a Logitech C270, and I recently got a C922. So I'll be switching to that. And as far as like my microphone goes, it's mainly just this Yeti Pro, not a Yeti Pro. It's the Blue Yeti, and the Rode PSA mic arm is actually probably more. I'm more interested in the mic arm, and it's more useful to me than the microphone, just because of how convenient and easy it is to move it around. Because I used to have another mic arm that was just such a pain, and this one is just like you just kind of use one finger and it's perfect.
It is, yeah, but it is really useful. I mean, we talked about this before, but I've got the same mic arm, and the other mic arms are available. We're not being sponsored for that, but
like it's great. It's really good.
Yeah,
There's other ones, but this is just one. It's like this. It's probably the first one I've had that's, I guess you can call it like a professional version or something. But there's probably something better. It's just this. I'm not much of an equipment guy, more of a software guy. So as far as like the way how I do my show, like live, I do it in OBS. And it's basically without OBS, the show would not exist. So I have a lot of respect and I contribute as much as I can to OBS because it's a fundamental piece of my my workflow. So I have like an insane amount of structure set up into – I even created like custom global variables that you can just do inside of OBS where you have one scene that is created to be a certain element and then it's put into another scene. Then you have another scene that pulls that one in. So like there's a multi-layered OBS structure. So I have probably like 40 scenes for each profile and then maybe like 10 to 20 sources in each scene. So it's a pretty complex setup for OBS.
Awesome. And since we're talking hardware, yes, I have the Blue Yeti as well that I use when I'm near home. Like today, I'm near home. I'm not actually at home, but it weighs 8 pounds, though. So it's really nothing I want to carry in my suitcase when I'm traveling on the road. So I have a Plantronics foldable headset that I use when I'm on the road. And that doesn't sound as well, but it does actually work. And I also have the C922, which is what you're seeing me on right now. And I really, really am happy with that. I had the C920 before that, and that used software to do the MP4 compression. This uses hardware to do that. So it's actually quite fancy. So yes, it's very, very, very much easier on my CPU. It used to be that my CPU would start pegging as I was doing my show because it was like doing all the compression to be able to stream up and do that up and down. I also have had interesting issues, but not with copyright, which is sort of weird. I did, I used to stream my live karaoke sessions. So I would sing songs that, of course, were licensed to be able to sing in the karaoke room, but weren't technically licensed to then be able to stream those. But I've never had a takedown from those. And I think it's because my voice obviously doesn't match the exact MP3 signature that would be on the original piece. And I'm hoping that's why my stuff is still on Ustream and YouTube. Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, I'd say that it's going to be in those cases where it's not exactly an infringement. They do the demonetization. And they don't actually strike you, so they don't give you a community strike. They just give you like a little certain demonetization that says like this: all the money made from this particular video, the ads will go to whoever claimed that particular video. So. And they used to do it where if you did anything that was caught at all, they would just strike you and then ban your account. Then they stopped doing that. So I think that was like 3 or 4 years ago they stopped doing it and just went straight to demonetization. And so it's been a lot easier for people. So because if a lot of people don't even care if the ads are – if they're making money off the ads anyway. So in some cases, people just do it anyway and just let it go.
Cool. And so what brought you to doing this particular podcast that you've been doing now for, I should say, the perfect number, 42 episodes so far?
Exactly. The reason why I started doing it is just because I'm just interested in Linux news. And I was already paying attention to all the news every day anyway. And it kind of just felt like a natural flow for me, mainly but also because I wanted to do a podcast in general, but I didn't have any type of like opportunity to do a co-host at the time. So when I started making the podcast, I needed to do some type of content that could be just me, and the news approach kind of felt the best. And it also allowed me to do like the excessive style of research that I do, because you mentioned earlier in the introduction, you're talking about how many topics I do. Anywhere between like most podcasts that are news focused are anywhere between like 4 to 8 topics. And I do a minimum of 10 up to 20. And that's just because I like to do, I just want to cut. I don't want to like pick and choose what is the most important, because there's a lot of things that are releasing in a certain week that are not getting enough attention. So I wanted to have at least about 5 topics I could put, you know, anything that I just felt interesting. So there's I'll talk about self-hosted software. I'll talk about distributions, of course, but also like apps people might not have heard of, command line tools, all kinds of different things to make sure that I can provide like a variety of content for people who are beginners to Linux and also people who are been doing it for decades.
And we actually have a question from the chat room. Aspire is asking, did the show always start as a video or was it audio only for the beginning?
Well, there was a video version, but I wasn't on the video. In the very beginning, it was just visuals of like what I'm talking about rather than me. And I think it was episode 7 when I added myself to the video part. And ever since then, it's just I've been a part of doing video like pretty much exclusively. But it wasn't really a video podcast until about episode 7.
And so what motivates you to do this? I mean, it takes time. You and I both know this takes time mm-hmm. to do. This is not a zero sum task. This is something where we are investing. I'm investing like 5 hours a week to do this show. The hour and a half that everybody gets to see, but also the time it takes to set up guests and for you, it's the time it takes to do the research and stuff. What motivates you to do that?
Well, mainly it's just a passion for Linux and open source and, you know, just Floss in general. I have a passion for it and I'd like to talk about it and I want to provide a way for people to get as much news as possible without having a ton of filler so they can get it. Well, my show is usually between 30 minutes to 50 minutes and I have anywhere between 10 to usually actually more like 15 to 20 topics. So I want to give as much content as possible in the least amount of time. And that's just the approach that I wanted to do because I have a passion for it in general. And as far as like the amount of time it takes to do it is a massive amount of time. I actually, the first few episodes, it's kind of interesting in a way that the first 1 to 6 episode when I talk about when I did the putting myself on the video, those first episodes were an insane amount of time, actually like a full-time job. I was spending like almost 40 hours on them. Every week because of how much editing it took and all the post-production and everything. And then like individual segments were recorded like piece by piece. And then when I started doing live, it actually helped me as far as like relaxing and doing the podcast more naturally. So like, cause as people are watching the whole time, if you screw up and you try to go back, like record it over and over and over, you're going to annoy the people who are live. So in that sense, it kind of helped me cut at least half of it down. So I'm probably doing about 10 to 15 hours of work on it now, and probably half of that is research into the content. Then there's probably like 2 hours of recording, and then after that, probably like two or three hours of editing.
Cool. Well, Dan's got a couple more questions, but before we do that, I do have an important message because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean provides the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications with Droplets, virtual machines that are a scalable compute platform with add-on storage, security, and monitoring capabilities. You can choose from standard or CPU-optimized Droplets and customize from there. DigitalOcean is designed for developers. The easy-to-use control panel and API lets developers spend more time coding and less time managing their infrastructure. Industry-leading price to performance. Access the computing resources you need at the lowest rates, saving up to 55% compared to other cloud providers. And you'll always know what you pay per month with flat pricing structure across all data center regions. Included at no additional cost. 99.99% uptime SLA. Cloud firewalls. Monitoring and alerting. Full DNS management, global data centers, enterprise SSDs, and easy-to-use API. Over 150,000 businesses, including some of the world's fastest-growing startups, including me, rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twit. That's do.co/twit. for a free $100 credit. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support of Floss Weekly. And now, Dan, you had a couple more questions?
Yeah, so we talked about this a bit at the start about having a co-host and doing all of that. I was really curious to ask Michael about how... So if you're doing, say, like a 50-minute show sometimes on your own, I mean, you've kind of answered this possibly already, but I was going to say, how do you get through 50 minutes on your own without someone to hand off to when you need to sneeze or when you need to, I don't know, do something else? How does that work out? Do you have breaks? Is that how you get past all that?
Yeah, there's a break for pretty much every. Sometimes it's every topic, but most of the time it's every two topics or so. And I'll take a break, so it'll be I'll do this one section recording, then I'll take a break, and then after I do the whole thing, I go back and edit the pieces where the recordings are. Mm-hmm. And I keep and OBS has a plugin that I actually contributed to that keeps track of where those parts are in the recordings and things like that. So there's a lot of it takes a lot of stuff to make it possible. And it's a fair question because it's a ridiculous amount of time for one person to constantly talking. But it's more of a I'm just very comfortable with doing podcasts and just having conversations like this. So it's not an issue for me as far as like what to say. It's more of an issue of like the how much air I can have in my lungs while I'm saying it. So I do take a little bit of break so I can breathe in.
Yeah, I was just going to say, do you know circular breathing? Because, like the saxophone players have to do where you breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth at the same time. Although I don't know if you can talk and do that. That might be tricky. Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, I know a bit about that. I mean, I used to do a music show, where I was the only host. But then that's really easy because I got to play songs as well. So I'd talk for, say, 5 or 10 minutes and then play two or three songs. And that gives me the classic radio DJ's break to, you know, go to the toilet, put a long song on. Go to the toilet or something. So there was always that. But the other thing is getting the news. That must be a real effort because, I mean, I was talking about when I did the show I was on, we had, you know, a couple of people and we could pool our resources. But keeping on top of all the stuff, how do you manage that? Like keeping, do you every day, do you get up and look through like, you know, LWN and all these other things?
Yeah, LWN is part of them. I actually have an RSS feed reader and it is just stacked with feeds. I have probably about 120 to 140 feeds that I go through each week. And it's a variety of different applications that are just like their change log and things like that as well. So it's not just like the news sites, but every news site you can think of that's Linux related, I have those included, even the ones I often don't agree with, like the registers. Anyway, there's quite a bit of things that I go through and I like to filter it down. So I start with anywhere between each week 600 to 800 topics to cover. And then I narrow it down to roughly about 50. And then I narrow it down even more to the chunk between 15 to 20 or so.
Wow, that's a quite a rigorous process to go through each time. And it feels a bit like in the free software open source kind of metaphor, they're a bit like your upstreams, aren't they? You're getting the stuff from them and then, you know.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's in a news way.
Yeah, that's my approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know a bit about how much work it can be to keep on top of that, and it's definitely a big effort, but it can be really rewarding as well. I should say, I mentioned that you don't have a co-host, but you do contribute to Destination Linux, which is a multiple hosted show. So tell us a little bit about that as well.
So actually, what I did with my show, I started doing my show's live streaming, and then some other people started like showing up from other channels and other podcasts, and started asking me to be a part of like be guest hosting on their podcast. So I've done a few guest hosts for a variety of podcasts, and then one day, one of the creators of Destination Linux asked me if I would like to guest host on the show, and then they asked me like repeatedly. And then after like the third or fourth time, they were like, hey, would you like to just stay on the show? And like, yeah, sure, why not? And then I was there for about a couple months or so. And then the guy who started the show decided to leave. And that was unfortunate, but it also gave me an opportunity to do some like tweaks and changes so that I could adjust the show to how I wanted. And it's not my show or anything. We have a collective effort in that show, which is... Because I already have my own show that takes a ton of time, I couldn't do another show with it that required me to do the same amount of work anyway. But I also do the editing for Destination Linux now as well for the video and the audio. So there's quite a bit to do, but I do enjoy talking about Linux and open source. So like these are just passion projects that I would like to do regardless. So What's interesting is that the show that I started by myself, I'm still doing by myself, and I have a ton of work put into it. And also, the kind of funny thing is that I'm very long-winded, if you haven't noticed. So I can talk about these topics all the time, all day. And I tested that one day to see how long a live stream I could do without getting bored or even getting up. And that was 9 hours. So that was just talking straight about the content about that week and stuff like that. And the average of my streams are anywhere between 3 and 4 hours or so. I do a lot of streaming, and then I cut it down to like only the bits that are the most important of that stream goes to the show. So like the show itself is a lot of information and a lot of content in a very small amount, but the actual process of getting it all there is a ton. But Destination Linux it was interesting because we now are adding another host. So not only is it like I have a co-host on another podcast, I have now three co-hosts with me for that show. And we're announcing who that person is later today when we release the episode that I'm still currently editing.
Yeah, it's amazing you got Linus Torvalds to do that. Oh, sorry. Oh, yeah. No, that's a joke. Exactly. Everyone's wondering. I was amazed he has got time for that. It's a very rigorous process, as we were saying, as you just pointed out. I was curious about how one of the things that we found with Linux Outlaws when I did that was the reason it was called Linux Outlaws is when we started Linux on the desktop, and let's not get into the whole year of the Linux desktop discussion, but Linux was not seen as a mainstream thing. It might have been on some servers, but it was like it was never going to go anywhere where an end user was really going to see it. And now we've got, you know, Android phones, and we've got Linux embedded Linux devices all over the place, and other things. Have things changed a bit for you? Because what we found was like towards the end of the show, we stopped having to explain what Linux was and why people should care, and it was more questions about like just basic desktop user stuff or other things. Have you seen a development? Do you think Linux has progressed in the time that you've been doing your show?
Oh yeah, there's definitely been some progression. As probably not as much in the difference of like, because I've only been doing it for these shows together in total for like 2 years or so. There's been a lot of progression over the time I've been using Linux, where I would say the word Linux and people would just completely be like completely clueless about what I'm talking about. And they're like, it's kind of like Windows, but not, it's better and all that. And they might not know what Linux is really, but they've heard of the term and are interested in finding out more. So I don't have to like pitch them the idea of what Linux is necessarily. So they know it's like an alternative to Windows, but they don't really know exactly. So a lot of the times my comments are, or questions that I get in emails as well, are like, what are my opinions and suggestions for various different things like distributions or like beginner distributions, or just, you know, what's the most, like what's the most interesting thing, like a distribution you could find to learn how Linux works and find like the underpinnings and the core and stuff. And I have other things like, you know, what's the best application for this particular task and stuff like that. So it's become more of a general topics, and there's the typical older question of what it is pretty much vanished at this point. There's still occasionally people who will have that question, but it's usually when I introduce the topic to them.
Hey, we're almost out of time, but is there anything we didn't cover that you want to make sure we cover about how your show is produced before we have to let you go?
Well, mainly I just wanted to say that the show is probably not like the most streamlined show that I do, but if you want to check out the Destination Linux, that one is actually we go through that show like just straight start to recording and then, you know, live to tape type. But if you're interested in a really long conversation of Linux and stuff like that, my live streams have a ton of interaction and stuff like that. So that might be like if you like the podcast and you want to, you know, experience the live stream, that might be something people might be interested in.
And I have to ask my two most important questions, which is what's your favorite text editor?
My favorite text editor is Sublime Text. But I would give an honorable mention to VS Code and Atom because they're basically clones of Sublime Text. So, and that's pretty much. I think Sublime Text is probably my favorite though.
I'm actually really enjoying VS Code. I mean, I've been an Emacs user for decades now. I think I can literally say decades. Yeah, decades. And but VS Code has got some amazing stuff when I'm editing a Dart code for Dart and Flutter applications. That's really cool. Oh, yeah. And your favorite scripting language?
Oh, scripting language. I can do a programming language and also scripting. So I'd say... Sure. Scripting would be Perl. Programming would be a power of three, which would be Python, Perl, and probably not the most interested of PHP. But I'm a fan of PHP.
If you're not watching the video, I am holding my hands up because you said Perl. That was important. That was very important. Thank you very much for saying Perl. The rare one in 10 guests now that actually says Perl. So that's really nice. I also want to let our audience know that part of the reason you're on today is because you wrote me, about 6 weeks ago, and said, can I be a co-host on Floss Weekly? And I am absolutely confirming that you'll be back as it goes as many times as you want. You have a good voice made for radio, which is always handy.
That's good.
And you're clearly in the subject audience, not subject audience. That doesn't make any sense. The target. You're smart about this stuff. See, they let anybody do the show. They let anybody produce the show, apparently, because they let me do this show. But clearly, I will have you back. And actually, you've already asked to be on next week's show. So I think you're going to be back as next week's co-host. So
awesome. I'm actually a big fan of the project that you're talking about next week. So that would be perfect for me.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. So that was Michael Tunnell talking to us about his podcast and becoming one of our rotating panel of co-hosts. Not that they sit in their chair and spin, but yes, that there's different ones every week. So what do you think, Dan?
Yeah, it was great. I was doing my rotating chair again there because I can't resist that joke for the visual joke. It was brilliant. It was a little bit like The Apprentice there. I thought at the end you were going to, the job interview, and you were like, no, it was great. Really great to chat to Michael. He clearly knows a lot about the subject. And also, I mean, I'm happy to admit that, I mean, I started using Linux in with the vengeance with you know, is that right, with the vengeance, anyway, in about 2000, so he's beaten me by a year there, so you could say is that Linux experience is older than mine, so that's something to know. So a lot of work goes into putting a show together, as we know, so really good stuff, and it's great that he's doing some putting out the content and promoting Linux, obviously, from my point of view, because I'm a big proponent of it. It'd be great to hear more from him in future.
Great. And Aspire actually said target expert is the word. I think it's actually closer than anything I was trying to come up with. So, yes. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about who's coming up. So next week, in fact, and Michael will be back as the co-host, is Invoice Ninja, which is a powerful suite of online tools. So you can invoice clients, collect payments, create proposals, expenses, time tasks, and more. And it's fully open source, including their Flutter app, which is why they contacted me, because they know I'm talking a lot about Flutter here on this show. That's the Google iOS and Android SDK to be able to build beautiful apps in record time. Following that is Kong, which is an API gateway. It's a form of middleware between competing clients and your API-based applications. That should be fun. Following that is Vista, which is a comprehensive suite of patient care software developed by the Department of Veterans Affairs over the past 35 years. Following that, and I can't believe we haven't done this show yet, OpenVPN. It's a free and open source software application. You might have heard of that. OpenVPN. Anybody use OpenVPN? Well, you'll be wanting to watch the show. Following that is YataDB, which is a new kind of database gate company delivering a proven database engine to your application. Following that, speaking of Flutter, we have Eric Seidel, who's one of the Google guys. Google guys. I say that with all clarity here. He's going to be talking about Flutter. Let's see. I can't actually tell you that there might be a release between now and then, but let's just say it's in late beta right now. And Eric's agreed to be on in December. So I'll just leave it at that. And we'll not go any further than that. I'm a Google GDE, so I'm under an NDA, which is how many letters can I do in one sentence? Anyway, but yeah, so I can't actually tell you what I know. But yeah, so Eric's coming on in December. That's all the way through the end of the year. We're opening up January already. We're going to have some more guests in there coming up soon. If you go to twit.tv/floss, you can see our big spreadsheet. If you have any other suggestions that aren't on that spreadsheet, please tell the project leader or community coordinator to email me. And especially if it's not cryptocurrency. We've had way too many of those shows over the years already. So we have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays at live.twit.tv. We took a number of questions today, mostly from Aspire. He or she has been very busy today, so that's been cool. You can follow us on Floss Weekly on Google Plus for at least a little while longer until Google Plus goes away. I don't want to find something new for that. Or at Floss Weekly on Twitter. You follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus and at Merlin on Twitter. And again, we're working out something to replace Google Plus. I'm sorry, Google, that they deleted. They're going to close this service down. It's been a great platform, quite a few. So it's sad. Anyway, I'm going to be just later this week at Seagull, which is the Seattle GNU Linux conference. It's a 2-day free conference. I'm going to be up there. I'm flying up tomorrow to go up there. I'm going to be at KubeCon. I guess it's about Kubernetes. So it's like I want to say Kube something. But anyway, I'm also going to be up in Seattle for that at the invitation of the CNCF. Also covering that as Floss Weekly. I have nothing else on my schedule at the moment, but you know, my schedule fills up. It's all going to be down there. And that's good. Anything you want to plug, Dan?
I'm doing it. Pardon me. I'm losing my voice now as well. This is a great advertisement. We need some new co-hosts quick. I'm doing a number of podcasts at the minute. If you want to find out, go to danlynch.org where I post about them, or go to Twitter where you can find me on there. And the name is @methoddan, like the two words stuck together. And we'll have to chat offline at some point, Randall, because I went to the Open Source Summit recently and lots of people I met there were very interested on being on Floss Weekly. And they weren't cryptocurrency projects. So we'll talk about that for January.
That's awesome. Yeah, I definitely want to fill January up as quick as I can, because obviously I hate having gaps in my schedule. And I have no gaps right now, but I hate having open slots. I want to have those filled as soon as I can. So cool. Well, Dan, it's been wonderful having you back off and on over the last few months, especially. And also very apropos for today's show, since you're a producer, a longtime producer of your own show. So you had some really poignant questions that I don't know that I could have come up with, since I've never done a news show. I've only done a magazine show like Floss Weekly. So a news show has got to be a lot harder on some levels, right?
Yeah, it is a lot harder. And I also got to complain about copyright as well. So that's my buzzword bingo thing ticked. I got to complain about copyright. I got to ask questions about producing a podcast, talk about Linux. Yeah, I'm good. I think I'm done. it was great. Cool. So thanks very much for having me on, as always. I'll speak to you again soon.
Cool. And I will be back on this show next week, as usual. But I'll be coming to you from south of the border, down in Tijuana way. So we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.